That's it for Women Making Waves for today. This is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, your favorite radio station. And stay tuned. Roshan is up next.
Hey, this is where I'll always be.
The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois, and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, May 4th, and this is episode 12 of The Rift. The Permian Basin is a geological area of accumulated sedimentary rock that spans over 80,000 square miles across West Texas and southeastern New Mexico. The basin is home to about 500,000 people. It abuts the Rio Grande, contains the stunning rock formations and canyons of Big Bend National Park, and its desert ecosystem is populated by an immense variety of wildlife, including some species that cannot be found anywhere else in the world. The Permian Basin is also one of the most prolific oil and gas producing regions in the United States. It contains tens of thousands of oil wells, which together are the source of nearly a quarter of the natural gas produced annually in the United States, and over 40% of the nation's oil. If oil is life, as the author Malcolm Harris argued in our conversation on the previous episode of The Rift, there may be no place in the country where that relationship is more visible and more literal than the Permian Basin. Oil and gas run the economy of West Texas. The volume of production is immense, and so are the consequences. A 2022 United Nations-sponsored report found that the Permian Basin was the largest source of pollution on the planet, producing over 200 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions in the year. Many climate activists refer to the Permian as a climate bomb because a huge portion of its projected climate impact is derived from wells that have not yet been drilled. If they are, the Permian Basin could produce more oil and gas in the next 30 years than it has in the past century. Gas production in particular has been supercharged in the Permian in recent decades, largely due to advances in hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, technology. In simplest terms, fracking means injecting pressurized water into a well in order to free up additional oil or gas to reach the surface. In the United States, the emergence of cost-effective fracking in the 1990s eventually led to an oil and gas boom, where reserves thought to be previously exhausted gained new life due to the technique. In addition to its disastrous climate impact, however, fracking is incredibly environmentally destructive locally. Methane gas flaring from fracking can negatively impact air quality and induce health issues in local residents. Fracking can also pollute groundwater and wells. And a 2021 study by the U.S. Geological Survey and the University of Texas linked disposal of fracking wastewater into the ground to the increased prevalence of earthquakes in the Permian Basin. Oil and gas operations in the Permian are also illustrative of the global nature of the fossil economy. Take, for example, the joint venture between American oil giant Occidental Petroleum, also known as Oxy, and Ecopetrol, the state-owned oil company of the nation of Colombia. Oxy and Ecopetrol are partnering together to invest nearly $900 million on 91 new wells in the Permian Basin. It's not Ecopetrol's first rodeo in the Permian either. The company's been operating there for years. Now, what exactly is Colombia's state-owned oil company doing extracting fracked gas in Texas? Well, the format of this episode is going to be a little bit different, as you're going to hear from two guests. The first is Andres Gomez, a Colombian petroleum engineer and climate justice activist with the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, as well as Fracking Free Colombian Alliance. Although Andres was unable to join me for an interview, he was kind enough to take the time to send a short audio recording of his analysis of the partnership between Oxy and Ecopetrol and how it relates to the situation in Colombia. After that, you'll hear my conversation with Sharon Wilson, a fifth-generation Texan and the director of the nonprofit organization Oilfield Witness, which works against the fossil fuel industry in the Permian Basin and beyond. Sharon spoke with me about the impacts and history of fracking in the Permian and what her organization is doing to fight back. But first, programming on WEFT is supported in part by Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County and the Habitat Restore. When you donate, volunteer, or shop at the Habitat Restore, you're invested in building homes, communities, and hope throughout Champaign County. Learn more about Habitat for Humanity of Champaign at cuhabitat.org or follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you by That's the Cut Barbershop. Located in Mahomet, That's the Cut is a retro barbershop offering professional haircuts and shaves. That's the Cut Barbershop, 601 East Main Street in Mahomet, 217-855-9673, and on Facebook or the Booksy app. That's the Cut Barbershop. And now, here's Andres Gomez on fracking from the Permian to Colombia, followed by my interview with Sharon Wilson.
Ecopetrol's current situation with the partnership contract with Occidental in the Permian is clearly a disadvantage for the company, contrary to what the oil and gas lobby would have the country believe. At the beginning of the negotiation, Ecopetrol paid 75% of the capex for the drilling of new wells and in return received only 49% of the oil. Ecopetrol required a 49% stake with the investment of $1.5 billion, and Oxy was left with 51% of the oil and as the operator of the field. If we see what oil expert Juan Gonzalo Castaño says, Ecopetrol 2022 Integrated Management Report, in June 2022, the expansion of the Delaware Subbasin in Permian was carried out with the signing by Ecopetrol With some subsidiaries of Occidental, a joint development agreement. In this GDA, Ecopetrol maintained its 49% interest in the rights to the drilling and production programs in the area and made no upfront payment, but committed to cover up to 75% of Oxy development investment as development proceeds. Activity in Delaware commenced in the fourth quarter of 2022, with proved undeveloped reserves of 48 million barrels of oil equivalent. Does this mean that Oxy only had to assume 12% of its investment for 41% of the production in Delaware? And did Ecopetrol assume 87% of the total investment for only 49% of the production? How much has this obligation amounted to, and how much remains until 2027, the year of termination of the contract for the Delaware sub-basin? Evidently, a great benefit and magnificent business for Oxy on behalf of Ecopetrol. In addition to the above, the situation of fracking in the United States does not seem to align with Trump's plans, and the obstacle are the prices of the barrel and the re-drilling cost associated with the high declination rates of fracking. In the last 12 months, the price of WTI crude has fallen by 25% and is now less than $64. According to specialized information on the subject, currently drilling new wells is financially viable at an oil price of $62 per barrel. With WTI crude at $64 per barrel, oil drilling is barely above break-even. Unsurprisingly, producers are prioritizing improving efficiency from existing wells rather than investing heavily in new drilling. According to them, a substantial increase in drilling activity would require WTI to average around $84 per barrel, which is far away from the present situation. And now, we must relate the Permian situation to what is happening in Colombia around the controversy over whether or not to do fracking. The oil unions and sectors of the company itself seek to use this supposed economical benefit for Ecopetrol in the exploitation of the Permian as the gateway for this technique in the country. They claim that if the business is profitable in the United States, it will be even more so in Colombia. An assertion which, as we have seen, is far from reality. For more than 15 years, there has been a strong and effective opposition from different sectors in the country to the use of this technique. Bills have been introduced 5 times in the Colombian Congress, and in the government program of the current President Petro, there is talk of the need for a ban on the use of this technique. And not only that, the current government understands very well that it is urgent to get out of fossil fuels. Hence, its policy is not handing out new exploration contracts and is leading at the international level with the proposal of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, which seeks an equitable and fair solution for the central cause of the climate crisis. Fracking would imply not only profound environmental impacts in a mega-diverse country as Colombia, more intense than those widely reported by academia and affected communities in the United States, but also high economic risk at a time in the world where the trend is precisely that demand will fall and climate policies will tighten.
I'm joined now by Sharon Wilson, Executive Director at Oilfield Witness. Sharon, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So you spent 12 years working in the oil and gas industry, and now you lead this organization that's aimed at halting oil and gas extraction. How did you get from there to here? What's your story?
Yeah, I worked in the oil and gas industry, not for an operator. The operators were our clients. So I doubt anyone in my office ever even saw an oil and gas site. So what we did is we helped the operators sell their production. The oil and gas industry is pretty good at getting oil and gas out of the ground. They don't know how to keep it in the equipment, keep it from spilling, keep emissions from blowing everywhere, and they don't know how to you know, at the time, they didn't have a lot of expertise in marketing that. So that's what the company I worked for did. And so I just worked in the office. I did leave that industry because our clients spent time in our offices talking to us. And I felt like they had a disturbing sense of entitlement. So if they thought of something and they could profit from this idea, no one should get in the way. And if anyone was hurt by that, it's their own fault. They should have been smart enough to get out of the way. And I, you know, there were some other things along the way that I just felt like the ethics of the oil and gas industry were pretty far from my ethics. And I grew to where, even though I was paid a lot of money, and they pay a lot of money to buy loyalty, I did not feel good being in that environment all day. So I left and I moved out to the country, about 60 miles from Fort Worth, where I was working, 60 miles north. And I didn't know it at the time, but that was in the heart of the Barnett Shale. And the Barnett Shale is where fracking was developed by a man named George Mitchell, who is known as the father of fracking. I didn't know it when I moved out and I bought 42 beautiful acres out in the country so I could live on the same property with my horses and my kids could experience, you know, growing up in the country and growing our own vegetables. And I didn't know that that's where George Mitchell was experimenting to learn how to frack oil and gas from shale. So I moved right into the middle of it. And I got a ringside seat to the fracking impacts. And I moved out there in 1996, June 1996. And 1997 is when the first well was drilled and fracked that actually produced oil and gas and was successful. So then it just started expanding all around me until my air turned brown and my water turned black. And I was dependent on a well for drinking water. So that was a pretty traumatic thing to happen. And it made me, after I got recovered from the trauma and the deep depression of realizing that America was not this paradigm that I grew up believing, where someone would come and help if something bad happened. No one helps if it's the oil and gas industry, especially back then, there was no one. So when I recovered from that shock, I got pretty angry about it all, and eventually I started a blog, and I wrote about what I was learning, and I started documenting lots of videos, photos of what I was seeing, and eventually I learned about open records request, which everybody should use that tool. That is, well, previously, I don't know how it will be going forward, but previously, we did have a right to request government records, and it's a very powerful tool. And along the way, somehow, from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, I received these videos. And I didn't ask for videos, but I received them. I didn't even know that this thing existed, where the video would start out as just a photograph of an oil and gas site. And then it switched to this black and white, video of what looked like a bunch of smoke coming out of these sites. And I learned that that was optical gas imaging. And I just knew I had to get my hands on that technology. And so it took a few years before I was able to do that. But in 2014, I became the first non-governmental, non-industry person to be certified to use an optical gas imaging camera. And that camera makes visible the invisible pollution coming from oil and gas.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I wanted to kind of ask a little bit more about that too, because of course, you know, especially with hydraulic fracturing, fracking, and natural gas, you have methane emissions, which you can't see, you can't smell. You have things like benzene and other different chemicals that can, you know, leach into water, that can get into the air. I lived in Detroit for a while, right by a Marathon refinery, and people around there had all kinds of issues with the emissions from the refinery. Can you talk more about like what this optical imaging lets you kind of see?
Sure. Optical gas imaging is a term that the Environmental Protection Agency made up in 2006 when they made the technology lawful to detect emissions from the oil and gas industry. And we use, Oilfield Witness uses a Teledyne FLIR G620. That's the model camera we use. It's really an instrument. It's a scientific instrument that has an onboard camera. And the camera has a filter that is calibrated to visualize hydrocarbon emissions like methane and volatile organic compounds like benzene. And it has an onboard camera. So the way that it works is if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, which is also called the light spectrum, humans see in the visible light range, which is represented by rainbow colors, but it's a 0.4 to 0.7 microns for the nerdy people. And most hydrocarbon gas absorbs infrared in a midwave range of that spectrum, which is 3.2 to 3.4 microns, and it's a very narrow band. And as these hydrocarbons escape out of the equipment, they absorb infrared light and become opaque if you're looking through the OGI lens. And then the instrument records that visualization with the onboard camera. And that's how it allows humans to see, quote unquote, see the methane emissions with the human eye. And so it's a very powerful tool because in the beginning, and even now, the oil and gas industry will put a facility right next to homes, right next to preschools in Arlington, Texas. Total Energies is drilling many, many wells right next to preschools, daycares, churches, schools, homes, backyards. And they just say, you know, we don't have any emissions. We're zero emissions. And people, you know, they know they're getting sick. They know they can smell hydrocarbon gases, but they can't prove it until, you know, someone with an optical gas imaging camera shows them that. So I felt like it would be such a powerful tool to help people, to help families, to help individuals who were impacted in the beginning by oil and gas. But now it's a much bigger issue. It is everyone around the globe is impacted, and especially by what we're doing here in Texas, because the Permian Basin is one of the worst. It has been rated as the worst, biggest emitter in the world. So we're up there at the top, always, even sometimes ahead of Russia. So it's a huge problem.
Yeah, and it makes me think especially of a lot of recent research in the past, I don't know, decade or so on methane emissions and what's essentially amounted to systematic undercounting of methane emissions, how invisible they are both to the naked eye and to our, you know, fancy emissions accounting. So more on the Permian Basin, what's made it such a hot spot for oil and gas production? And could you talk a little bit more about the consequences for the land and the people around that area in West Texas?
So first I want to just say something about the greenhouse gas accounting, which, you know, the emissions inventory, which is supposed to keep up with the greenhouse gas emissions that has always been a self-reported inventory. And for decades, the industry has underreported their emissions. And in any other country, that would be called fraud. But we've just put up with it. And so a lot of people are upset that Trump has stopped the greenhouse gas reporting, but it was just a bunch of lies. So, you know. But back to your question, the Permian Basin is, you know, there's always been drilling out there, but it pretty much died out until 2015 when Congress overturned the decades-old crude oil export ban. And so there was a ban on exporting oil from the U.S. And the reason that was important to the Permian Basin is because the oil produced there is light sweet crude, and we don't refine that, or we have very limited refining capacity in the United States. So that oil needed to be exported. So when Congress overturned the crude oil export ban during Obama's term, that allowed the Permian Basin to start booming. And they're targeting the oil. But the oil and gas and wastewater all comes up together out of the same hole. And this, the Permian Basin area has a lot of associated gas. It used to be, I think, 40% gas. Now it's way more. As they pull the oil out of the formation, it becomes gassier. So it produces a lot of gas, and they don't really want the gas. And even though they can sell the LNG, the price of gas in the Permian Basin is very low. Most of last year, it was negative or just very low. So it actually costs them money to ship it to market, to transport it. So there's a lot of methane and volatile organic compounds going into the atmosphere, just being dumped. And that is a huge impact to our climate, and it's a huge impact to the people who live there locally. They are getting exposed to very high levels of hydrogen sulfide gas, benzene. We analyzed data from the limited air monitors in the Permian Basin and found that people there are getting exposed to very high levels of these gases that are harmful. And, you know, you can't talk about oil and gas production without talking about the intense water usage, because in the United States, it's pretty much all coming from shale. It requires fracking. That's millions, millions of gallons of water for every well, and, you know, trillions of gallons of water that the industry is using, and that water, they basically turn it to trash and throw it away in a deep injection well, which causes earthquakes. So the impacts to the people who live near this kind of oil and gas production, it's huge. It doesn't just start on the Gulf Coast where the refineries and the LNG export terminals are. It starts at the hole in the ground. And every stage, every single stage has intense pollution that is making people sick. A recent study from Colorado found that the more production that you live by, the higher chances that children will have leukemia. And so they linked it not just to the proximity of the production, but how much production there is. So the people in the Permian Basin, but even in Arlington, you know, in other areas of Texas, we have drilling all across Texas. So it's a huge problem.
Yeah, and the companies operating in the Permian Basin, I mean, they range from, you know, your small outfits to some of the largest oil majors around. And the industry as a whole has this massive PR machine, endless money and lawyers. How do you go about challenging that kind of behemoth that sort of operates almost above the law?
They definitely operate above the law quite often. It's very hard because we're a small organization, but we're very, very lean and mean. But it's hard to get the videos that we take. This is evidence. They're not just videos. This is scientific evidence. And the videos that I've taken, some of them have been used in court. So it's evidence that pollution is happening, that harm is happening to our planet, to the people who live nearby. But it's very hard to get that evidence out on a widespread basis. Because when you go to see a movie and you pay to get in the movie, you pay a ridiculous price for popcorn and a Coke, and you sit down to watch the movie, and what do you you have to watch? An advertisement by Shell telling you how wonderful they are and that you couldn't have the life you have without Shell, you know. And we can't put our, you know, I would like a response to that to be, yeah, and look here, maybe you want to think about this. This is what you're breathing. And it's not just in the oil and gas fields. It's everywhere. When you put gas in your car, gasoline, the fumes come up into your face. It, you know, it's everywhere. So I feel like if people could see these videos, that there never would have been a fracking boom to start with. If you could see this with your bare eye, they would have started putting wells in next to people, and there would have been a lot of mamas going, oh, hell no. this is not going to happen here. But, you know, because they gaslighted people into believing that this is clean energy when it is not. So it's very hard to get this information out. And I have personally had to fight two lawsuits from the industry, one a multi-billion dollar company. So, you know, slap suits, which, you know, there's a law, there is legislation against slap suits. I don't know if that will still stand. Greenpeace didn't have a lot of luck fighting that in North Dakota, but they will appeal. But, you know, I was fortunate. I got good attorneys and I fought those slap suits and won. But it's not been easy.
Yeah, I mean, an organization like Greenpeace, we actually just had them on a couple weeks ago, just talking about that lawsuit in North Dakota. And it's tough scenes when an organization as resourced as they are is facing that kind of repression. So I understand that one of the projects that you're focused on right now is led by the American oil major Occidental Petroleum, known colloquially as Oxy. They just renewed a joint venture with Ecopetrol, which is the state-owned oil company of the nation of Colombia. They're investing almost $900 million, developing as many as 91 wells out in the Permian Basin. There's a lot to talk about, I think, but first, I know that you have some stories about Oxy and their practices in Texas and the effects that they've had on people.
Yeah, I do. And this is not the first time that we've been colonized by other countries. There's many other countries operating in the Permian Basin. But if Oxy is the one helping Ecopetrol to figure out how to frack and produce oil and gas in the Permian Basin, they're not going to do it very well. I can tell you that for sure. They're everywhere that I see Oxy facilities, they have emissions. They have a lot of old, rusty, cruddy equipment everywhere. On this one man's ranch in West Texas, he has this beautiful, beautiful ranch that's been in his family for six generations or more. It is covered in Oxy equipment that is rusted, broken, trash. It's covered in their trash that they didn't bother to clean up. There are a bunch of leaky wells everywhere, and I've been on this ranch with my optical gas imaging camera, and, you know, I've got the evidence that they are not good operators, and they don't pick up their trash. And I don't know, we learned that in kindergarten, pick up your trash. But they're just these wells that they have, some of the older wells on this ranch are leaking from the casing. And that is a problem for the groundwater out there. And there's so little groundwater left because the oil and gas industry is just sucking it all up. But in New Mexico, I was giving a tour to some lawmakers. I was asked just to give them a tour and let them look through the camera. And one of the sites that I picked out was Oxy, that was right by a school. And it was big, big pollution coming out of this site. And, you know, the industry as a whole cannot produce oil and gas without pollution. And they keep talking about methane intensity, you know, our intensity is down. The climate doesn't care about your intensity. It cares about how many molecules of methane you're releasing. And it's a physics problem. The industry does not follow many laws, but they have to follow the law of physics. And these gases build up pressure, and as they build up pressure and the molecules bounce around and build up pressure inside of steel equipment, you have to release that pressure or it will explode the equipment. And that's a law of physics. So, you know, the industry saying that this is clean energy, it'll never be clean energy. And just even to maintain it so it can be cleaner, maintain the equipment, to repair it, to replace it, it would cost the industry a lot of money. And obviously, from looking at Oxy's equipment, they seem to be focused on expanding new wells and leaving behind all the old stuff for taxpayers to clean it up. We have to save money for our retirement because, you know, nothing's free here. We have to save money for our retirement, but not the oil and gas industry. They don't have to save money for their retirement. They expect the American taxpayers to pick up and clean up after them.
Yeah, I was wondering, actually, are orphaned wells a big problem in Texas? I know that that's just generally something that happens with the oil industry, is that you leave these wells and they're like significantly degrading the land and potentially the water table. And there just doesn't appear to be any sort of plan for remediation or anything of the sort.
No, it's a huge problem. In fact, they don't even know how big the problem is in Texas, because the Texas Railroad Commission, which has nothing to do with railroads, they regulate the oil and gas industry, but they don't have a handle even on how many abandoned wells there are. But all over in West Texas, these wells, so they have the wastewater that comes up with the oil and gas. And they call it produced water because they want to put a